Good evening. Pakistan's Prime Minister warns of war while at the United Nations.
Would I want to live this humiliation? Would I want to live like that? I would pick up a gun. You're forcing people.
And the impeachment debate, who is to blame? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Saturday, September 8th, 2018. 2019. The presidential election in Afghanistan has been marred by violence that has followed the collapse of the U.S.-Taliban peace talks, as well as numerous technical issues. The voter turnout is described by observers as low. The polls were held in the war-torn country on Saturday. The elections had originally been scheduled for April 20th. Yet were delayed twice over technical setbacks and changes in election laws. The voters were choosing from among 18 candidates, including the country's incumbent president, Ashraf Ghani. The vote count will take weeks, with the preliminary results expected not earlier than mid-October. The election followed the collapse of the peace talks between the hardline Islamist group and Washington early in September. The Taliban warned more than 9 million registered voters would be told to steer clear of the polling stations and the Taliban threatened to attack the polling facilities. A federal judge, meanwhile, has ordered the Department of Homeland Security to set aside a plan that would make more people vulnerable to expedited deportation until a court can rule on the matter. The lawsuit filed by We Count and other immigration advocates asked the Washington court to overturn a plan making undocumented people eligible for deportation without court oversight unless they could prove they've been in the country more than 2 years. Previously, only those immigrants detained within 100 miles of the border who had been in the country 2 weeks or less could be ordered rapidly deported. The policy makes an exception for immigrants who can establish a credible fear of persecution in their home country. And the White House severely restricted distribution of memos detailing President Donald Trump's calls with foreign leaders, including Russia's Vladimir Putin and Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, after embarrassing leaks of his conversations early in his tenure. That's according to a former White House official. The White House handling of Trump's calls with foreign leaders is at the heart of House Democrats' impeachment inquiry. A whistleblower alleges the White House tried to lock down Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukraine's new president because officials were worried about Trump's request for help investigating Trump's Democratic rival, Joe Biden. The anonymous whistleblower alleges the White House also tried to cover up the content of other calls by moving memos onto a highly classified computer system. On Friday, the Trump administration confirmed the whistleblower's claim, saying national security lawyers had ordered the change. Meanwhile, Kurt D. Volker has resigned as the Trump administration's special envoy for Ukraine. He's the first casualty of Congress's impeachment inquiry into President Trump's conduct with that country. Volker tendered his resignation to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Friday within hours of an announcement from three House committees that the veteran diplomat was among State Department officials who would be compelled to testify. A Thursday hearing has been set for Volker. The impeachment inquiry will examine whether Trump abused his office to lean on Ukraine leader to investigate Trump's political rivals and whether the White House tried to cover it up. Russian expert Jeremy Kuzmarov is author of The Russians Are Coming Again. He says that all the hubbub around the whistleblower was a discussion of U.S. policy towards the Central European country.
One thing that disturbs me is that there's no broader discussion of U.S. policy in Ukraine. I mean, if he was cutting aid to Ukraine, that would be a good thing. I mean, he may have done it for the wrong reasons, or was purporting to do it for the wrong reasons, but there is a dirty war. The United States had supported a coup d'etat in February 2014 and was fighting a dirty war in Ukraine, and that aid was helping to facilitate. And also, Biden has done some really shady things, so especially that his son was profiting off that coup, very shady. And his son had no experience in the oil and gas industry, so why is he being appointed all of a sudden as board of directors of a major Ukrainian company? It's a form of kind of shameless profiting off U.S. foreign policy intervention after the coup. So there's a lot of wrongdoing in a lot of places, and not just Trump with regards to Ukraine. And this could backfire for the Democrats. Investigation might illuminate more on Biden's activities and also might just shed some light on U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine. And it was really the Obama administration that orchestrated the U.S. support for the coup d'etat in 2014. So not only Trump, but others stand to lose out. And the thing with impeachment is that the Senate is very unlikely to vote for Trump's impeachment. So this could backfire again on the Democrats politically, just like Russiagate did.
You mentioned earlier that there was a dirty war in Ukraine. Define that. What do you mean by a dirty war in Ukraine?
Following the coup d'etat, because Ukraine had been ruled by a pro-Russian leader, Viktor Yanukovych. Now, there was corruption in his government, but he was elected. Protests broke out in late 2013. They were presented as these pro-democratic protests, and some of the people in the protests may have been sincere, but a lot of the protesters were paid, and there were far right-wing elements that infiltrated that protest movement, some with neo-Nazi leanings, and they were worshiping Stephen Bandera, who's a Ukrainian nationalist who had collaborated with the Nazis, and they didn't get enough signatures for impeachment, and they forced Yanukovych out through violence, and carried out these black flag incidents where they, snipers shot at civilians and tried to blame the Ukrainian military that was still under the control of Yanukovych. And then the eastern provinces are Russian speakers, and their economy is very tied with Russia, and they distrusted the new president. The new president that was installed, Petro Poroshenko, was a corrupt oligarch, and they passed these language laws that pushed the Ukrainian language, and that was in the front in the eastern provinces where they're mostly Russian-speaking. So they voted for their autonomy, and the Ukrainian military invaded those provinces, and 13,000 civilians were killed, over a million displaced, and the war is still going on after 5 years. And the United States was funding all this with providing heavy military and other support to the Ukrainian regime, and providing military equipment and even military advisors. And this started in the Obama administration, and Trump continued with his policy expanding the aid.
So Trump has really been continuing Obama's policy towards Ukraine?
Obama packaged it as non-lethal military aid, and Trump, with some reluctance, agreed to provide lethal military aid, I think some anti-tank weapons. So he actually escalated the degree of U.S. military support. But Obama had initially sent U.S. military advisors, like their regiments from New York as well as Oklahoma, where I live, were sent to Ukraine. And some of the battalions they were training were actually, there were far right-wing elements in the Ukrainian military, some with affinities for Nazism and very anti-Semitic people that were actually being trained by American advisors. So it was very disturbing. It's in our media. It was barely covered in the U.S. media. And Russia was blamed for everything, but Russia's intervention really was more reactive.
Zelensky, who is the president there?
Yeah, he's a comedian. What happened is that following the coup d'etat, the United States helped to install a pro-Western regime led by Petro Poroshenko, who is a billionaire oligarch and his business was in the chocolate industry. But his regime was extremely corrupt and unpopular, and the government really was mismanaging the economy. And ratchets up this war in the East. So he was incredibly unpopular. And kind of as a protest vote, in the last election, Ukrainians voted in a comedian with no political experience who had mocked the corruption of the oligarchs like Poroshenko and his television program. And this may spell a new day for Ukraine. You know, he's made some overtures for peace, and there's peace accords. There's a big meeting that's scheduled soon between Ukraine, Russia, and some European countries. So there's some hope that the conflict in the East might end.
What you're saying is that Zelensky is basically a moderate reformer who's looking for a way out of this war, and the United States, the Trump administration, is withholding aid and making other apparently veiled threats to them to get them to do things.
The withholding of aid seems to be only for a short period because the Congress voted for new aid provisions. I mean, the war has still been going on under Zelensky. He's saying he wants to end it. Hopefully, these peace talks will lead to an end to the war, but it hasn't ended as of yet. So the United States and Trump administration is still supporting the war with these weapons shipments, and it was only a temporary halt for a very short period. Then Trump gave the green light. I mean, it's hard to know what's going on behind the scenes. Zelensky was, his primary financier was an oligarch named Ihor Kolomoisky, who was very deeply involved in the war in eastern Ukraine. So some people don't trust him and see him as a kind of false reformer. And there are different theories. One theory is that, you know, Trump was trying to kind of move the venue of the Cold War from Russia to China and wanted to promote a détente with Russia, although there are elements in the U.S. government that have been, you know, stirring up a lot of Russophobia. And with the Mueller report, he was under a lot of political pressure maybe to abandon that approach. I think Steve Bannon had that approach, that the real enemy is China, and that the U.S. should forge better relations with Russia to prevent Russia and China lying from each other, you know, lying with each other and forming a powerful bloc against the United States. So I think that was the Bannon strategy that Trump may have wanted to pursue. So some of the meeting, maybe he was trying to encourage a, you know, peace talks with Russia and an end to that conflict, but there was also pressure coming from the other side to sustain bellicose policy towards Russia and to vilify Russia. So it's hard to know exactly what's going on behind the scenes.
That's but for sure.
I think Trump was constrained, yeah. I think he may have, you know, wanted, again, better relations with Russia, but he may have been constrained.
And that's Russian expert Jeremy Kosmaroff, the author of The Russians Are Coming Again. And 3 years ago this month, or next month, the story of the so-called Steele dossier, written by Christopher Steele, an intelligence agent and employee of the Democrats, was made public. The memo came days before, or the release of the memo came, or the information about the memo really was released or came from unidentified sources at the time. Came before the Trump victory in 2016 and after the release of a memo by then FBI Chief James Comey accusing Hillary Clinton of hiding emails, a release by Comey, information and a memo by Comey that was often credited with her loss of the election to President Trump. David Korn is the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones. He wrote the story back in 2016 in October that broke the existence of the memo, the Steele dossier, days before the 2016 election.
It was a massive Russian plot to influence an American election to benefit Donald Trump. That has always been the major story. And the other part of the major story was that while this was happening, the Trump campaign had interactions with Russian emissaries and Russian cutouts that sent a signal to Russia, to Vladimir Putin's government, that they did not mind this intervention. They welcomed this intervention, as Donald Trump even did publicly when he called on Russian hackers to go hack Hillary Clinton. So that's always, you know, so that part of the story, contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia, Russia having a plot to help Donald Trump win, have always been the essential components of this tale. And that is something that Christopher Steele did capture in a large sense in those memos, even if a lot of the rumors and, you know, tidbits and salacious speculation that he put in the memos have not been proven true.
This is a president who now, since before he was president, now as president on numerous occasions, he's openly called, said that it was okay to work with a foreign power, that there's really nothing wrong with that. So is this an issue, a political issue? Some people say it's okay to work with a foreign power in an election, and others say it isn't? Or is there something more going on here?
There's a lot that's wrong with that. But let's just look at the most recent news. We know it is that Russia attacked the election with very extensive information warfare to influence our presidential campaign to get the result they wanted, Donald Trump in office. So as soon as he gets in office, a few months later, he meets with the Russian ambassador and the Russian foreign minister in the Oval Office. And according to the latest report in the Washington Post, based on three sources who are at this point anonymous, Donald Trump told the Russians that he was not concerned with the attack. He didn't care about it, which is also giving them a green light to do it again. So here's an attack. It's not a military attack, but it's an attack on the United States. And the guy who's in charge of defending the United States takes an oath and swears to defend the Constitution. And he's telling a foreign adversary that had successfully attacked the United States, it's okay if you do it again. We're not going to go after you. This is giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Some people might even want to call this direct treason.
Is this a president? I mean, the first thing you think of in a situation like this, if what you're saying is as accurate as it might be, that this guy is owes something or somebody owes something to somebody?
We don't know if the Russians have anything on him, but he certainly, has not punished them. And he's taken Vladimir Putin's side numerous occasions in terms of saying this didn't happen. So they seem to be more or less in sync. And he's recently tried to get them back into the G7. But the Russians are not in the G7 because they invaded and now have occupied part of Ukraine. And obviously an illegal occupation. Yet here he is going to the president of Ukraine, who's trying to figure out what to do to get the Russians out, and saying, well, we may give you military weapons that you like if you do me this favor. If you do me this favor and give me political dirt that, is bad for Joe Biden and that also undermines the Mueller investigation, which is about what? It's about the Russian attack on the United States and interactions between the Trump campaign and Russians. It all goes back to Russia, Russia, Russia.
What about the Ukraine? But you mentioned the Ukraine a minute ago, which is a separate country. The president.
But when he's talking to the Ukraine president, the key items are really about what to do with Russia. And I wrote a piece this week that describes and explains how releasing this transcript or quasi transcript, we don't know how accurate it is. It's not a word-for-word transcription of a tape recording. But in releasing, this memo about his conversation with President Zelensky of Ukraine has been a tremendous boon for Russian disinformation. They've gone to town with this because it looks like, indeed, the U.S. and the Ukrainian president are involved in some underhanded trades, extortions, quid pro quo, whatever you want to call it. In the meantime, Trump is saying publicly, well, you know what? You got to work it out with Putin. That is not the position of the rest of the Western world, that Ukraine, you're kind of on your own and you and Putin can work it out. The rest of the Western world, the European Union and other allies we've been working with on the sanctions against Russia because of its occupation of Ukraine, the sense is no, there needs to be a united front. And this isn't about negotiating how much territory Putin gets to keep in Ukraine because he invaded it illegally. Everything that we do with Ukraine really seems to be connected to Russia. And what Trump is doing, or has done last week, was to put Ukraine in even a worse position vis-a-vis its conflict with Russia.
Giuliani, is he just an errand boy, or is there something going on with Rudy Giuliani?
This is, kind of crazy that he's out there as the president's personal lawyer, yet he's trying to talk to representatives of a foreign government, in conjunction with Trump's calls to them in order to get political dirt. And now Giuliani says that, he did this basically with the knowledge or approval at the behest of the State Department. And he has text messages to show that, which led Kurt Volker, the special envoy to Ukraine, to resign this week when he got drawn into this. But the question is, okay, so the State Department's envoy to Ukraine was talking to Rudy Giuliani about this effort to get dirt on Biden in Ukraine. Well, who told him to do this? Did Donald Trump enlist the State Department through Mike Pompeo or not to work with Rudy Giuliani, his personal henchman, to get, negative information on a potential political rival? That would mean that it's not just Rudy Giuliani freelancing. It would mean that Donald Trump has enlisted the rest of the executive branch in this effort to dig up derogatory information on a political foe. That, I think in a lot of ways, that could well be illegal. He's not supposed to be using the U.S. government for his personal political ploys and schemes and purposes.
And David Korn is the Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones. And in international news at the United Nations, while Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi avoided any mention of Kashmir in his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Pakistan's Imran Khan launched an extraordinary attack on his Indian counterpart, warning of a bloodbath in the disputed region. Khan on Friday said there would be a bloodbath when India lifts its curfew in Indian-administered Kashmir, currently facing an unprecedented security lockdown for nearly 2 months. Here's part of Imran Khan's comments at the General Assembly.
If there is a bloodbath, there will be Muslims becoming radicals, not because of Islam, but because of what they will see, that there's no justice when it comes to Muslims. There were Rohingya Muslims, Myanmar, who are, God knows, almost 1 million people out, ethnic cleansing. What was the response of the world community? So what do you think will be the response of 1.3 billion Muslims? I picture myself. I'm in Kashmir. I've been locked up for 55 days. I have heard about, and there are rapes, Indian Army going into homes, soldiers. Would I want to live this humiliation? Would I want to live like that? I would pick up a gun. You're forcing people. You are forcing people into radicalization. When people lose the will to live, what is there to live for? And this is what, if you can do this to human beings, you are actually radicalizing people. There will be a reaction to this. Pakistan will be blamed. Two nuclear armed countries will come face to face like we came in February. And before we head in that direction, the United Nations has a responsibility. This is why the United Nations came into being in 1945. You were supposed to stop this happening. I feel we are back to 1939, Munich. Czechoslovakia has been taken, annexed. What is the world community going to do? Is it going to appease a market of 1.2 billion, or is it going to stand up for justice and humanity? If this goes wrong, you hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst. If a conventional war starts between the two countries, Mr. President, if a conventional war starts, and anything could happen, but supposing a country 7 times smaller than its neighbor is faced with the choice, either you surrender or you fight for your freedom till death, what will we do? I ask myself this question. And my belief is, la ilaha illallah, there is no God but one. And we will fight. And when a nuclear armed country fights to the end, it will have consequences far beyond the borders. It will have consequences for the world, which is why I repeat I'm here. Because I'm warning you, it's not a threat. It's a fair worry that where are we headed? And I've come here to tell the UN, you've got to, this is a test for the United Nations. You are the one who guaranteed the people of Kashmir the right of self-determination. They are suffering because of that. And this is the time. This is the time not to appease, like in 1939 appeasement took place. This is the time to take action. And number one action must be that India must lift this inhuman curfew. which has lasted for 55 days. It must free. It must free all political prisoners, and especially those 13,000 boys that have been picked up. Parents don't know where they've disappeared. And then the world community must give the people of Kashmir the right of self-determination. Thank you.
And that's the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan. Speaking before Khan at the United Nations General Assembly, India's Modi broadly denounced terrorism but avoided any mention of his decision to revoke the special status of the Muslim-majority region, also claimed by Pakistan. As the two leaders spoke, large dueling protests supporting and opposing India's action in Kashmir took place across the street from UN headquarters in New York. And that's some of the news for Saturday, September 28th, 2019. The news was engineered by Ken Gale. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. And by the way, I'll be joining you tomorrow hosting our reading, the last episode of our reading of the Mueller Report at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio, New York.